Welcome back to another edition of the JDD podcast, Ask the Investigator. I'm your host, Dr. Adam Friedman from the GW School of Medicine and Health Sciences. I am so happy to introduce and welcome a longtime friend and colleague, Dr. Beth McClellan, who is an assistant professor of dermatology at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, is director of the Division of Dermatology at Jacoby Medical Center. Dr. McClellan specializes in complex medical dermatology and has a special interest in supportive oncodermatology, which is the treatment of dermatologic diseases in cancer patients. She's received awards for this work. She has published extensively, lectures all over the place, both in the dermatology world and in oncology. And even beyond all this work, she still has time to run the New York Vitiligo Support Group, which for which she is one of the co-founders. So thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us today.
Thanks so much for inviting me. Happy to be here.
So we're going to be discussing your recent study published in the June edition of the JDD entitled A National Survey of Medical Coding and Billing Training in United States Dermatology Residency Programs. So first things first, what was the impetus for this study?
So since I started at Einstein, I've been giving lectures to our residents about basics of billing and coding in dermatology. And we were interested in finding out if other programs had such a curriculum in place, just realizing how complex and difficult billing can be to learn. We wanted to see how good dermatology residents were at it and how much they're learning about it.
Now, I think one of the very impressive things with the study was your great response rate. Survey studies are usually pretty easy to put together. I think they can generate a lot of useful information. The rate limiting step is how many people respond. And you guys got a significant percent response rate. You know, how did you disseminate the study? What were some kind of things you picked up along the way that really enabled this great response rate that then gave you, reasonable data and statistically significant data?
Yeah, that definitely can be a challenge in doing survey studies that I've faced in the past. And it can sometimes make publishing a paper difficult, and I think rightly so, because if there's a low response rate, you never know how the results are biased. But yeah, in this case, we were really lucky. We disseminated the survey online using SurveyMonkey, and we sent it out to, we contacted program coordinators or program directors and asked them to send it to their residents. And we also, using SurveyMonkey, were able to track who exactly it was sent to so that we could accurately calculate a response rate, make sure we weren't sending it out to people who weren't actually receiving it, because that can skew things if you have a larger denominator. I think a lot of it was just luck that residents were willing to get back to us. And I have to say, since doing survey studies, I'm always a survey participant when I receive them in my own inbox now. Pay it forward.
I love the recommendation there. I use SurveyMonkey. We actually have a departmental account, and I think it's, there's no conflict of interest here or financial interest. I don't get paid by SurveyMonkey to say this. I think tools like SurveyMonkey, and there are other ones out there, I agree. I think they make it a lot easier, and they allow you to really track your data as well as, really analyze it in a meaningful way once you pull in, God knows how much hopefully comes in. So with that good response rate, what did you guys find out?
So we found that dermatology residents overall are doing pretty well. So most of them are receiving some type of training formally in coding, including lectures given by their attendings and or professional coders. Most residents say that they bill the visits themselves, and some residents do 100% of the billing for outpatient dermatology visits. And then we asked residents just like some basic scenarios and asked how they would code for those. And we found that most of the residents did a pretty good job. So they knew the definition of a new patient versus an established patient. They were able to describe which elements should be included in deciding the code for an office visit. And when we gave a clinical scenario, 70% of the residents were able to correctly choose an office visit level. But we also found that residents did not feel very confident in their billing. Most of them felt that this should be integrated into part of their training, and many of them were interested in some type of web-based curriculum.
Yeah, I mean, for starters, I think usually these types of studies, when you read the title, my automatic assumption was that you found that residents didn't know anything and that they really didn't feel confident. And I was very surprised to find that a good percent actually did know very, basic, coding, coding fundamental knowledge, and they, did get some training, but you're right. It's not part of the curriculum. It's not, part of the milestones as part of the new accreditation system that kind of follows residents over time to ensure that they are competent. So I think that's a good point that maybe there should be an element of their training. I know we've started to see questions on, in-service training exams that include, a couple coding questions maybe here and there. But I agree. I think a study like this should hopefully be the impetus for a deeper dive in terms of understanding what is really required and needed in residency curricula. From the study, have you changed the way, you mentioned you lecture the residents. Have you changed how you lecture the residents about this, like how the format of your lectures, or maybe you added some different data points or different points of information that you think are relevant based on this?
I mean, my approach to teaching billing has changed over the years, just, as I learn what works and what residents are asking for. I think one thing that came out of this is my interest in some type of web-based curriculum, which I think would be great if there was some standardized curriculum for residents that they could do online, either separately from their formal training or in addition to. But I find that, a combination of lectures and reviewing real-world cases has been a good way of teaching residents billing. And then also one thing that our residents have been asking for recently is kind of like a regular audit of their charts to actually go through where they coded correctly and coded incorrectly and why. But I have to say, I think I feel in a lot of ways the same as the residents here. And I spend a lot of time reading about coding, but I still feel not completely confident because it is complicated and convoluted. But really, one thing I always tell the residents is the amount of time we spend memorizing things that you may only see once in your career, and then billing, we spend so little amount of time, but it's one of the few things that you'll actually use in almost every encounter that you walk into. And it's not something that's intuitive or comes naturally. So really, you do have to study it as though it's another pathway that we're memorizing.
No, absolutely. And you mentioned that there's clearly a need for an online standardized based system to teach basic and maybe advanced coding. What we don't have that yet, but what resources are available for residents or newly graduated faculty or those in private practice that they can turn to hopefully get their bearings?
So I think there are a lot of great leaders in our field who are really good lecturers when it comes to billing. I've heard some great lectures from Alexander Miller and Dirk Elston. And so I always encourage residents when they're done with residency and they're able to go to conferences where they can actually learn about practical things and not just board spotter to seek out some of those lectures in different meetings. There's some good mailings through the AED, like the Coding Correct, that has good case examples and answers to questions. I look up the old ones of those all the time when I'm trying to find the answer to something. And now there's some good online groups where you can discuss both clinical cases and billing questions, and I learn a lot from my colleagues that way too.
That's great. Now, obviously, we can spend probably hours going over basic, dermatology related coding or just even medical coding. And of course we don't have hours, but I was wondering if you have any very basic pearls, given, and I think that auditing approach within the residency is a great idea, especially if you know what to look for in terms of auditing. Based on your experiences, what are some basic pearls that are most relevant based on your experiences with the residents that you think everyone would benefit from hearing?
I think some of the trickier parts of coding for dermatologists are the modifiers. So when to use a 25 modifier and also 59 modifiers. And sometimes even the coding experts within large institutions have a difficult time sorting that out, because it seems in dermatology, I think we're much more likely than any other specialty to do multiple procedures at the same time and do procedures in addition to an office visit at the same time, or even an office visit and multiple procedures. So we use a lot more modifiers than other specialties. And I remember once in residency, one of our coding lecturers, who was not a dermatologist, was saying, "Well, why would you ever freeze something and biopsy something?" And I was like, "Well, we do that every day, so using those modifiers, I think it's worth taking the time to read the actual criteria for when they're correctly used and when they're needed. And then one other thing I always tell the residents is, you know, don't ever, you have to question everything. I've learned a lot of rules over the years that turned out to be someone's interpretation that weren't necessarily true, like the definition of a complex closure, or what's the definition of wide undermining? Does it have to be a centimeter or 5 centimeters? Or, you know, what's a complex IND versus a simple IND? You hear different definitions of these things. And I think often it's because there really isn't always a clear definition. So you can't always listen to someone's hard and fast rule without looking at what the actual codes entail and what's needed.
Actually, an interesting conversation came up recently with my residents, and I actually didn't have a good answer for it regarding 59 or excess modifiers, excess for the Medicare population. And it never even occurred to me that this would be an issue. But in terms of if you do multiple procedures, which one do you choose to put your 59 or excess on? My thought and what I'd been told in the past was you always want to put it on the one that has the higher RVUs. And then to your point, someone else said, no, it's actually on the less RVU one. Have you come across this question? It just seemed intuitive to put it on the higher one, but I didn't really have a good answer for that.
Yeah. So I have a quote in my coding lecture from myself that 59 modifiers are the most, I don't remember, it's like annoying and difficult part of coding. And I think it's like intentionally difficult. So I'm not surprised to hear the RVU thing, because this is Einstein residents routinely think this, that it's either the higher paying or the higher RVU. But you actually have to look at the Medicare coding correct. Forget the actual name of the document, but there's this PDF that you can download from Medicare, and it has two columns, and you have to look at the two procedures and see which one's in the right column, and that's the one that gets the 59. And it doesn't always have to be the one with higher RVUs or higher reimbursement. So really, to know the right answer, you have to go back to that document and see if the procedures are listed together, and if they are, which one's in the column that needs the 59.
That's fascinating. I mean, I think to your point about having an online webinar resource or even website, even just having that so readily accessible and people knowing that you need to look to that, because I had no clue, that would be exceedingly helpful.
You always have to wonder if this is made intentionally difficult, but
well, it's in the same bucket as prior authorizations and step edits. I mean, they're just creating roadblocks to make sure they keep their money, I guess.
Exactly.
So, you know, we just saw recently the introduction of ICD-10, which to me, I think one of the greatest foci is on laterality and being as specific as possible, saying right arm versus left arm, things like that. Can we expect any more changes in the near future that we really need to know about as it relates to dermatology with respect to coding?
I'm not sure I'm so tapped into changes that are happening in that world, but nothing that I've heard of on the horizon.
Got it. Now I'm going to switch gears a little bit to kind of go back to something I mentioned in your introduction, which is supportive oncodermatology, somewhat of a fledgling field, though certainly getting a lot of attention given as the number of new targeted therapies go up, so do the number of cutaneous adverse events, many of which are expected. I would hope now that, a lot of the residents and even those out of practice are somewhat familiar with the papulopus eruption of EGFR inhibitors, as well as HER2 receptor inhibitors, hand-foot syndrome with multi-kinase inhibitors, and all the fun stuff that comes with taxanes. But because we keep seeing new drugs, new well-established, well-correlated reactions are also emerging, and would just love your take on what are some of the newer ones we should be looking out for?
New toxicities?
Yeah.
Yeah, so definitely with the newer immunotherapy agents that are being used, we're seeing more immune-related side effects. So many of these agents can cause just like a generalized morbilliform eruption or pruritus, but we can also see immune-related toxicities like psoriasis and often vitiligo, bullous pemphigoid, and a whole host of things are being described. I think it's so interesting now to see the JAD case report list, because it seems like a higher and higher percentage of them are chemotherapy or immunotherapy-related toxicities, and just like very interesting single case reports of weird things that they're causing. And it's it's so interesting to see new things just emerge all the time. The other thing is, as many of these drugs are being rolled out to new cancers, it seems in my experience that those oncologists who may specialize in a cancer that wasn't really using targeted agents before have to go through a new learning curve. So sometimes I see, you know, our lung cancer specialists are very comfortable treating papillopustular eruptions now, but some other cancer, you know, oncologists who specialize in other types of cancers are not. And so they are more likely to send them in sooner without having started doxycycline themselves. So I have to keep in mind, you know, what type of oncologist I'm dealing with and how long they've been using targeted agents and immunotherapy. And that will probably only continue to expand as these drugs gain additional indications. So that's interesting to be, I guess, the stabilizing force who's been there from the beginning of the drug's introduction.
You bring up such an important point that to be successful at this, you really need to have a good collaborative relationship with oncology. And that can be tough because they're, you know, in many cases, so pigeonholed in going after the cancer, which obviously is life-threatening in many cases. And also some may not even know that things can be done or things can be done to prevent these adverse events. How have you coordinated with them? I mean, obviously you've been at Einstein doing this for quite some time. You go to the cancer center, but you know, early on, can you remember, how did you really engage them to get them on board with sending you these patients? And like I say, from my experiences, it's been quite difficult to get them to make those referrals because there's so much else going on. It's hard for them to remember that we can do a lot for these patients and improve their quality of life, which you've shown can have tremendous, you know, these adverse events can have a tremendous impact on quality of life from some of your research. So what are some tips to really engaging your fellow oncologists to make sure they're sending you these patients, not even once the reaction occurs, but really before it does, because there are some things which I'll ask you about in a moment that we can do to prevent a lot of these reactions as well.
That's definitely a challenge at the beginning. And I've started a similar type of program, you know, at a couple of different institutions. So along the way, I've learned some of the barriers that oncologists face when referring patients. And I hear uniformly the number one barrier is wait time. So oncologists often need to know within a matter of days what drug they're using is causing the rash. Can they treat it? Is it serious or do they need to change drugs? If they're not able to get their patient seen in dermatology in that quick time span, they'll likely just change the drug, which often doesn't need to be done. So one thing that I always do is let oncologists know I'll see their patient the same day or at least within a week, because I'm not at the cancer center every day. And if they need to be seen the same day and I can't see them, I'll find them someone to see them the same day. So that alone is a big barrier to breakthrough. Once oncologists know that they can get someone quickly, they'll use you. A lot of times they just don't have the time to spend on the phone, calling the doctor directly, getting them in. You know, it's just too much of a hassle. So an easy way to get patients seen quickly by a dermatologist is, I think, the number one step. The second thing is to keep in mind that patients often, like you said, the oncologist is very busy. There are many different side effects that patients are facing apart from their skin. Patients often perceive the skin-related side effects to be quote-unquote less important, or they don't want to sound like they're complaining, or they don't want their oncologist to change their treatment, so they may not even report these side effects. So I think it's really important to establish a relationship with the nurses and the mid-level providers in oncology, because often they're the ones who are managing the side effects, who are seeing the patients in the infusion center, who are dealing with these day-to-day problems and can make the referral directly without going through the actual oncologist. So I've done nursing journal clubs. I've gone to infusion centers to introduce myself. I've given lectures in the infusion center. When I first started at Einstein, any referral, I would send a letter back to the doctor with my card saying I would see their patients the same day. A lot of it is just about building relationships, building trust, getting things done quickly, and hopefully having happy patients who report back that you're making a difference for them.
Great points. So let's say things go right and you get a referral, you know, a patient shows up before they're actually about to start, whether it be a chemotherapy regimen, targeted therapy, and obviously different drugs cause different problems. Before even delving into any of those, is there some basic education or advice you give patients who are about to enter this, you know, journey with the infusion center, maybe long-term oral therapy, that kind of apply to everybody?
Yeah, I mean, it's rare. It's still rare for me to see people before they start treatment. But a lot of times patients
have a progression of their disease. And so they're changing therapies. And so it is nice to know, you know, you're going to be starting this. This is what you can anticipate. This is what you can do. I would say some of the more universal things are dry skin. So almost every chemotherapy causes dryness. And in some cases, people who didn't have eczema before therapy, they develop eczema because their skin is so dry, or their eczema gets worse, or they're just really dry. So I always go through just like basic dry skincare about using emollients, gentle soaps, lukewarm water. I mean, the same thing we tell any other patient with dry skin. And especially for the hands and feet, you know, just letting them know they can use thick moisturizers under occlusion, gloves and socks to help things penetrate. I think those things are really helpful for really any type of cancer treatment.
In terms of, you know, specific drugs, I mean, this is still very early on in terms of the research that's been performed to date, but I think there has been some work showing that certain interventions for particular types of medications and the associated adverse events can actually limit or prevent some of those reactions. Could you maybe review a couple of those?
Yeah, so there is some evidence that keeping the hands and feet cooled during taxane chemotherapy can prevent nail toxicity. So that's one thing I usually tell patients, or, you know, it's one of taxanes are very commonly used in treatment of many breast cancers. So, you know, I get questions from friends and family a lot, you know, my friends starting chemotherapy, what can they do? Usually they're getting a taxane if it's breast cancer. That's one easy thing you can do. And most people say if they have the opportunity to stop their nails from falling off, they'll gladly take it. and that's something that's often not suggested by the oncology team. So cooling of the hands and feet, either using ice water baths or cold gloves and booties, is something to consider before starting a taxane. You know, there's evidence showing that using doxycycline and a topical steroid prior to beginning treatment with an epidermal growth factor receptor inhibitor can help prevent development of the papulopustular or acne type of reaction. It's less common for me to see those patients before they start treatment. So it's not something that I'm able to do so often, but that's something to consider if you see someone before they actually begin. They can start some doxycycline and hopefully not get itchy, unsightly rash. There's scalp cooling to prevent hair loss with some types of cytotoxic chemotherapy. Definitely, I think the dry skin care and photo protection and hand and foot care are things that can benefit many people. In people who are getting multi-kinase inhibitors like sorafenib or sunitinib or regorafenib, a lot of those drugs that target many different kinases, they develop a painful reaction called hand-foot-skin reaction, and it's recommended that those people try to eliminate any calluses or areas of hyperkeratosis before they begin treatment. And so that could be done by a podiatrist, a dermatologist, or even just a pedicure to make sure the calluses are gone before they start can be helpful.
That's great. So given there's obviously a lot to know here, are there resources out there for those who aren't in the heart of it? Because I feel like even for someone like, you know, I also see a decent amount of this. There's so many new drugs and so many new reactions. You know, are there resources or societies that, you know, really focus on that for those who want to learn more, or, you know, what want to kind of just reach out and kind of ask questions, or, you know, anything whatsoever with respect to helping these patients?
Sure. I mean, the main group that focuses on this is the Multinational Association for Supportive Care in Cancer, or the MASC, and they have their own journal that's really good. It includes all different toxicities related to cancer treatment, but often I find other articles in the journal really interesting about even nausea, vomiting, pain control, neuropathy. You know, a lot of those things are relating to our patients as well. They have a meeting every year, which actually is going on right now in Vienna. And let's see what else. You know, a lot of times I'm still looking up. I have patients who come in on trials on drug MK43298, you know, and I don't know what that is, but if I Google it and I find it's a multi-kinase inhibitor, I kind of know what to expect.
Right.
Or if it's an EGFR, you know, a different EGFR inhibitor, or if it's something completely different, you know, I look on PubMed, I look on Google, and I just record everything I see in case it's something new. Always reach out to colleagues and see what they're seeing. You know, today I had a patient who had some weird pattern of hair loss, and she said it started on Prolia, and I look it up, and sure enough, there's cases of alopecia areata reported on Prolia. So I mean, just having the time to look things up and see what's been reported before. And if it hasn't, maybe it's a new toxicity, which makes this field really exciting.
So, and it can end up in the chat, like you said.
Exactly.
Well, thank you so much, Beth, for joining us. It's always a pleasure speaking with you. And, you know, obviously you always offer so much insight and useful information. And of course, everyone, please make sure to tune in to next month's edition of the JDD podcast. Thanks for joining us.